Welcome to this episode of the Mycotoxin and Chronic Illness Summit. I'm so excited to interview Dr. Lauren Tessier today. Dr. Tessier is a practicing naturopathic physician licensed by the state of Vermont. Her practice, Life After Mold in Waterbury, Vermont, is the East Coast's only formally certified CIRS literate naturopathic practice. Life After Mold services patients suffering from multi-system illness complicated by comorbid conditions such as MCS, MCAS, and chronic infections, including Lyme and co-infections, EBV, CMV, and more. Dr. Tessier also provides clinical and corporate consults to physicians and corporations looking to improve their respective clinical and productivity outcomes. Dr. Tessier has served ICI, the International Society for Environmentally Acquired Illness, since 2017 in the roles of secretary, vice president, and now president. The free e-booklet, Mold Prevention 101, authored by Dr. Tessier, has been widely circulated and its suggestions implemented by many worldwide. Find Life After Mold on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and Pinterest. Welcome, Lauren. I'm so happy to have you join us today.
It's such a blessing to be here. Thank you so much for having me, Dr. Parpia.
Thank you for being here. Yeah. So I know that your approach, it's actually pretty similar to my approach to treating mold and mycotoxin illness. I'd love to hear you talk about how our approach is different than some of our colleagues. So,
sure. It'd be my pleasure. So to kind of get things started, I think the key to really understanding the way we approach things is grasping the difference between mold and mycotoxins and how it can kind of interact with the body. So I know this is the mycotoxin and chronic illness summit. And so you guys by now, I'm sure, are like bored to death with the concept of what is a mycotoxin. But just to kind of run over really quick, guys, you know, a mycotoxin is something that is produced by molds, by fungi, by yeast. Not all molds produce mycotoxins. And so these two things, while they often go together, they are not synonymous with one another. And as a result, they can operate in the body differently and cause different disease states. So when I'm working on approaching these things with people, what I really knuckle down on is what part of this mold mycotoxin dichotomy is really occurring or causing problems for these people. So in my approach, I think I kind of distill down mold illness into four different subtypes. And usually people think, oh, mold illness now synonymous with CIRS, but actually CIRS is just one of the subsets. And so how I actually have people think about it, I have a little drawing here, is four overlapping circles. And you guys don't need to have anything else in your head for that other than just that visual. And so each one of those overlapping circles really represents a disease state that can come about from mold and or mycotoxin exposure. And so two of those circles are something that's widely accepted in the greater medical community, which would be fungal allergy and fungal infection. And in fungal infection, I kind of lump in colonization too. So these are things where it is actually physically the mold organism that is interacting with the body. We have the mold potentially in the body for an infection and a colonization, or for an allergy, we have the mold in the environment. And so the other two circles are how mycotoxins really interact with the body. And because the mycotoxins are there, the molds may or may not be there. And I'll get into that in a second for folks. And so those other two circles are CIRS, right? That's one of them. And the other one is mycotoxicosis. And mycotoxicosis breaks down really myco, meaning fungi, right? Toxic, that component, and eosis is the disease state. So it's the disease state from the toxic exposure to mold. So with mycotoxicosis, you can have mycotoxin exposure in the environment. So in the inhaled environment, you can have it in the food you eat. You can also potentially have it, and this is where it starts getting kind of nitpicky, in some of the mold that might be in your body. And you can also have it stored away in like some of your fatty tissues. So in the brain, the liver, sub-Q fat. So with mycotoxicosis, the mold may or may not be there at this moment. And then finally, there's like the CERS component, which I give people the metaphor. It's like setting up a bonfire and putting gasoline on it and lighting a match. And so you can have that fire go, and at some point the gasoline's going to burn off, but the fire keeps going. And in that metaphor for CERS, mycotoxins, and it can be lots of different things, but mycotoxins are the incendiary. It's what really gets the fire going, gets the inflammation going. And even after you detox someone or clean them out, that inflammation can still continue. So that's because of the kind of way I've defined mold illness in my practice. It allows me to sit down and kind of put people and try to understand how their cases may be presenting, which then further allows me to understand what tests to order to answer the clinical question I'm looking after. And also, of course, what treatment, because a fungal allergy treatment is going to look a lot different from a fungal infection treatment. So that's kind of how my approach is different from the traditional kind of CERS biotoxin mold folks.
Thank you, Lauren. That's great. It's actually pretty much the exact same way I look at it as well. Doesn't surprise me at all, because we have so much in common in the way that we practice. We're both on ICI together. I want to stop. Yeah, I know, it's so exciting, right? I want to stop and talk about the allergy piece and the carriage piece. So most of our patients will go to an allergist, and the allergist will test IgEs. Mm-hmm. And then in mold illness, IgEs don't really show up. What we found in our clinic is that mold IgEs, molds are not expressed that way in an allergy. So the patient comes back from the allergy clinic and says, I was told I don't have a mold allergy. What we do is we test mold IgG allergens, and we can just do that on LabCorp even. They have a great panel. And I find those very, very high in my patients who have an allergy. So I'll see those levels at 20 to 200 plus. And that's a really big deal. And so I think that it's really important to put some light on that piece. It's a piece that's really, really overlooked a lot. And I find that when we put them on a mast cell activation syndrome treatment, you know, that those IgGs, when they're in the 200s, they're certainly going to come down, and the symptomatic reactions of that allergy are going to be different. And I also want to bring up the point that the allergies, the presentation of the allergies will be different. It's not just a runny nose or hives on the skin, but we can see that allergic response in the gut, in the bones, in the connective tissues, because that's where mast cells live. They reside in all those tissues. So the mold allergy can be there. And just so happy that you're looking at that too, because it's not something that enough doctors are looking at. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is mold carriage, that some doctors think that there can't be mold carriage in the body. So Dr. Tessé, tell me more about mold carriage in the body. Let's talk about that.
Yes, I would love to talk about this. So in my formal training, when I became CERS certified, of which I am no longer, I was taught that it is impossible to carry mold in the sinuses, because the AW, which is the kind of grading for the water content, is too low. And that's all well and good. Maybe it is pretty dry in my nose. That's fine. But we have so much data now about the microbiome, right? Not just the microbe, but the MYCO. And we're seeing that, you know, we have naturally occurring fungi that hang out in our microbiome. And these guys can secrete mycotoxins. There's this really cool piece of literature that I love and I love referencing. And it is about how vaginal candida can secrete gliotoxin, which is huge for immunocompromise, into the local vaginal bowl, whether or not, you know, they've measured if that's been absorbed. I would say yes, but, you know, we also rely on data on that front. But, you know, it's a perfect example of something that's in your body, the carriage, colonization, spitting out mycotoxins and potentially leading to that mycotoxicosis. So yeah, you know, when you know better, you do better. And so my thinking has very much evolved over time with that. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that's exciting. I know when we do a nasal swab, I'll find funguses in there a lot.
Oh yeah.
In addition to Marcons, but it goes way past Marcons. It's not just Marcons, but there's a lot of bacteria and funguses and biofilm that can be found in there. And once the sinuses are treated, life changes for people. Mm-hmm. I've seen they can think straight again. You think about how close the sinuses are to the brain. Inflammatory cytokines can cross the blood-brain barrier. Mm-hmm. Infections can. I don't know if mycotoxins can.
They can. I know this. I know this for a fact. We have animal literature, and I'm a big, I spend way too much time in PubMed and in the animal literature. I'm really forced to do a lot of animal literature assessment because it's unethical to put someone in a mycotoxin box and run tests on them, you know? So we have to work with the data that we have. And these are also the animals that we test our drugs on. So why wouldn't we take that data into consideration? And unfortunately, that is a big argument for those viewers who are watching. It's, well, it's only in the animal literature. And you're like, well, it's also unethical for me to do this to a human. So, you know, it's nitpicky. Anyway, so to go back to the nasal component, they found that insufflation, which essentially placing things into the nose of, I believe it was T2 toxin, which is something that's produced by STACI, typical black mold, your trichothecene group that you'd find in a black, dangerous black mold. They found that it has the ability to dissolve into the olfactory nerve and then dissolve up the olfactory nerve and cause oxidative damage to the olfactory bulb in the brain. So it's the perfect example of like dissolves like, that being your nerves dissolving that lipophilic substance of the mycotoxin into that tissue, and it just kind of navigating up into the brain. Like, the blood-brain barrier theory has been falling apart over the years. And, you know, that's a good example of it in action. So yeah, it's so true. And another piece of interesting data, and it's an unfortunate piece of data, is a mycotoxin study that was done in Nigeria of children, and it was post-mortem. So they did autopsies, and what they found was aflatoxin in the high fat tissues of the body. So not only the liver and kidneys, but huge deposits in the brain, which lets you know it's coming from systemic circulation and crossing the blood-brain barrier. And whether that's coming through inhalation or oral, that, as far as I'm concerned, at that point, it doesn't matter. You just got to clear out the system, you know?
Yeah. And then, and we also know from research that there can be vagal nerve translocation from the gut up to the brain. So now we can have translocation from the sinuses via the olfactory through that research and by the vagus nerve. So there's a lot of, I think, other translocation areas in the nervous system that just haven't been discovered yet, which can give us direct access to the brain, which then makes me circle back to the sinuses and colonization and how important treatment there is.
And I think one thing I'd like to drive home though for people is colonization is really important, but if you're not out of mold, please reconsider pushing someone to prescribe you antifungals, because antifungals, they can be a little rough on the liver. They can be rough on the heart. Not a lot of people realize that. You know, less so with something that's locally delivered versus orally and systemically delivered. But if you're still in a water damaged building with mold, you can potentially re-inoculate yourself. And then that antifungal is all for naught, and you may have just built resistance. So I'm right there with you guys.
Yeah, absolutely. And same with, to continue with other detoxification, the use of binders, because the mycotoxins also going to be, oftentimes I until somebody's out of the environment, I'm just chasing the illness, you know, so getting them out is really important. But while they're still in the environment, I'm right on board with you about continuing treatment, mm-hmm. using the antifungals.
And in general, it's a really good rule of thumb that you've just demonstrated. Like, you don't do a kill until all of your detox pathways are open and supported, and you got a mop and a bucket to also clear stuff up as it comes through. Because you'll just, you'll flare and, you really can't. I think a lot of people get excited about the process of detoxing from mold, but it is not a fast process. It is not a sexy process. It is not glamorous. It's long. It's drawn out. It's boring. But if it's done right, it's a world of difference for people, right?
Absolutely can change your life when it's done correctly. Right. So absolutely. So let's talk about autoimmunity. I see it a lot in my patients, and I want to hear about how you see it in your patients. How does it present in your patient population?
Autoimmunity, I tend to have a lot of females in my practice. I think in general with holistic and alternative medicine, there tends to be a larger female practice anyway. But the largest issue that I tend to see in my clients is Hashimoto's thyroiditis. Or an autoimmune thyroiditis. Every now and then I'll see like a Graves pop up, which is the hyper versus the hypo of Hashi's. And then the other thing I tend to see is what I consider to be nondescript autoimmunity. So autoimmunity is there, we just don't know what the heck it is. So for some of you who might be familiar with autoimmunity, we do like an ANA, and then depending on what else we see, there's little kind of subtests that we can do to kind of differentiate it. And additionally, sometimes we look at the clinical picture and we say, oh, you have five of these 25 symptoms, that's more lupus-y, or, you know, vice versa. And what I find with these clients is they just don't fit any of the typical autoimmune issues, but we tend to see like a speckled or diffuse pattern on their ANA pop up and be essentially devoid of a proper autoimmune diagnosis.
Right. I see this all the time too. Oftentimes I'll see people with the Hashimoto's diagnosis, but then an autoimmune tendency in the rest of the systems. And I think of the thyroid as being the canary in the coal mine. It's the first one that's going to speak when there's an autoimmune tendency in the body. And so it'll pop up in the thyroid first, and then we'll find even anti-GLAD and antibodies elevated, though they might not have a diagnosis of celiac. But we'll see that tendency in the different systems of the body. So tell me why you think this is happening. Tell us about autoimmunity and why it is so often the case for people with mycotoxin and mold illness.
I think the unfortunate part for autoimmunity that tends to happen is that patients aren't empowered. Well, I mean, in general, any disease state, right? Patients aren't being empowered, and they're not being explained about what is happening. So kind of stepping back, so it's not too much jargon. Your immune system has a few different branches. You mostly have your white blood cells, and then there's a few different subtypes, and those are the guys that go to bat and they fight for you. In one of those subtypes, you have lymphocytes, and those lymphocytes are further broken down into B cells and T cells, and your B cells tend to be the ones that secrete all your antibodies, and your T cells tend to be the ones that are like on surveillance and doing the march, right? So within that T cell subset, this is where the autoimmunity theories really start to get put together. There's a type 1 T helper, there's a type 2 T helper, there's a Th17 or a T helper 17, and then there is a Treg cells, and there's lots of other super subsets you guys don't really want to listen about, but your type 2 helper cells, your T helper cells, some type 2, they tend to be more involved in the allergic response. And then your TH1s and TH17s tend to be more involved in the autoimmune response. And then your T regulatory cells are like the cops in the space, or the mediators, let's put it that way. And they're supposed to kind of keep everyone in check. And so what we originally thought with autoimmunity was that the TH1s were too high compared to the T regs, but as things have been kind of marching on, we're realizing that it's more the TH17s that are tending to have more of a big impact in autoimmunity, and also what they secrete, which is IL-17. So in an autoimmune picture, sometimes we'll have elevated TH1s. Most of the time we will have a very elevated TH17, and also what they make, which is IL-17, and that's a cytokine. It's just a chemical, inflammation chemical. And then what we also see is a low Treg set count, essentially the mediators that go in and keep everyone under control. So with autoimmunity, there's a couple of other things that can potentially happen. Some of our anti-inflammatory cytokines, of which we definitely have, are also suppressed. So like our IL-10, which is supposed to be protective, is also really low. And then we also see some of our antioxidant pathways start to have troubles too. So something like our NRF2 can be slowed down and kind of gummed up. So, of course, if you go into the medical literature and you pull some animal studies and cell studies and all these things, you see that mycotoxins, various of them, have the ability to increase your TH17s, increase your IL-17, drop your Tregs, lower that beneficial IL-10, and lower that beneficial NRF2. So they really just set the stage for some of that immune system chaos to really occur. So it's that's kind of how I've made the connection with mycotoxins and autoimmunity.
Thank you for that. And then I also think about the body as being stuck in a loop of that. So when we're first exposed to an infection or an environmental toxicant, an insult like that, the body goes into an oxidative state, and that's normal. And that's to help deal with this issue, right? That the immune system's a way of protecting itself and handling the infection. The problem is when we get stuck in a loop, and then we're not able to get out of that loop, and that's when I believe the autoimmunity can present. And so getting stuck in a loop that's supposed to be a healing loop, at that point's no longer healing, because we need to be able to get out of that loop and go on to the next stage of healing. That's being stuck in the cell danger response, actually, in CDR1. And I think there's so many other factors that lead to us getting stuck in these loops. So what I find is a lot of people will have structural integrity issues or other infections, dental occult infections. Those are huge. They'll also have tick-borne illness at the same time, and a high environmental toxicant load. And so it's the mycotoxins and the molds interacting with other environmental toxicants and other infections. So we've got this big soup of infections and toxins, and I've seen that for sure.
Oh yeah, and it's in the data. You know, it's exactly what you said. We know that infections spike those TH17s, and we know that infections are spiked with IL-17. But from the flip side, from the research, we've seen that if you suppress IL-17, you become at a higher risk of having an infection. So you're right, it's this really super careful dance. And you know, that TH17 connection with infections, absolutely, it's there. It's for sure there.
Yeah. Tell me about mold and autoimmunity.
Yeah, so it, I'm sure to some folks that might sound like the same question, and kind of, you know, mold again and mycotoxins, they're kind of two sides of the same coin. It's like you can have yeast, which is the organism, and then you can have alcohol, which is what the organism makes. So it's very similar. It's the organism for for the mold, and then the mycotoxin of what it makes. So we know that the mycotoxins can increase gene expression of autoimmune issues, which is kind of trippy, specifically type 1 diabetes and Hashimoto's. And we also know that mycotoxins can worsen issues with colitis and IgA nephropathy. And we've also seen mycotoxins worsen a lot of the demyelination and neurological symptoms of animal models of MS. So that's like the mycotoxin component, but looking at kind of mold as the organism interacting with the body, there's a good amount of literature, and, you know, starting with animals, we see that, for example, candida worsens a lot of these autoimmune models in animals, including, again, the rundown, the MS, the irritable bowel disease, and that IgA nephropathy. And that's all well and good, but, you know, people get really nitpicky about the human animal studies, but there are some really great human studies of mold impact on the body, where we've seen that there is a correlation, demonstrable correlation, between fungal antibodies, so meaning that there's been an exposure or infection, to MS, SLE, so lupus, psoriasis, Crohn's, and sarcoidosis. We've also seen, for instance, mold and fungi existing in the body worsening autoimmune disease states. So we know the severity of something like primary sclerosing cholangitis. So it's when kind of the liver and the gallbladder get really bound and tied up, and fibrosis, and they stop really working really well. That severity of that disease is worsened with the presence of candida in the system. And we've even seen things like being exposed to mold in an environment, in particular, there's a big one called Aspergillus fumigatus. It makes gliotoxin. It's dangerous, it's problematic, can cause infections, lots of stuff. But we found that people who are sensitized to it from an allergic standpoint, so they actually have that IgE antibody, they start cross-reacting with the mold's cellular components with their own. So it's like an autoimmune IgE that can happen for folks. And I think that that was a really little interesting piece of data that I bumped into. And then I think some of the other things that are really compelling come out of the clinical evidence that I mentioned that we don't get to have a lot of, but thanks to some of, you know, some bigger names from the 90s and the 2000s, Dr. Campbell, Dr. Thrasher, Dr. Gray, we have these great studies that show that people who are exposed to water-damaged buildings actually have a very, very strong correlation to developing ANAs, so that kind of first pass of autoimmune disease testing. And then they have actually a lot of neurological antibodies that then develop. And then they also have a few other antibodies, like your smooth muscle antibodies, chondroitin sulfate antibodies, mitochondrial antibodies. And these are hitting like joints and liver and nervous system. And this is all stuff that has like a confidence interval of like 95%. So it actually like sticks to the wall, you know? So we do see measurable levels of autoimmunity in people who have been water exposed, water damaged building exposed. And I think one of the most profound studies that was kind of, again, a longitudinal study, was in Finland in 2017. There were a group of teachers who had been in a building for a long period of time, and they found that their autoimmune disease rate was 36.6%. When you back out and you pan out to the general population of Finland, that is typically about 5 to 8% for autoimmunity.
Thank you for bringing up all of these studies. It's so important. Medicine takes a long time to catch up with the literature. That is for sure, because most patients are told that this is idiopathic. We don't know why you have an autoimmune condition. This is it's just in your genes, and you're just getting old. And it's just, the literature is there. Right. That mycotoxins infections, mold, and other toxins do cause autoimmune conditions. And when you were talking about the different areas that the autoimmunity presents, well, our patients feel that symptomatically in all those areas. So, right. It's just, we are ahead of the curve mm-hmm. because we are taking into account the literature and as well the clinical experience of our the doctors who came before us and our own clinical experience. And I'm seeing those two match up greatly, and just medicine just needs to catch up.
And it just, I feel like the wind has been taken out of my sails. Like it bums me out so much, so, so much. It's so profoundly upsetting. And, you know, we had a human rights activist in 2017 who went before the WHO, who essentially said, chronic Lyme disease has no representation in our diagnosis code bank. And as a result, that is a human rights violation. We can't offer these people, because we can't diagnose, we can't offer them care, we can't research, we can't do any of this data collection. Her name's Jenna Lush Thayer. If anyone wants to go, I really suggest, she's phenomenal. But we really need to have that done for mold and mold illness, because right now the only diagnosis codes we have are fungal infection and fungal allergy. There's no true ICD-10 diagnosis code for SIRS, so there goes that representation. And there is no true diagnosis code for mycotoxicosis. There is one if you eat too much aflatoxin-coated grain, but that's really it. That's where it stops. There's no like neurological mycotoxicosis or any of these things. And, you know, if any of your listeners happen to be someone who has any type of connections into into this field about how we can get a sea change going or something along those lines, please reach out, because this is a goal that I have in my heart. It's going to take a while, and but I really want to drive that representation, because as soon as we have representation, it opens up everything for our clients. So, we got to catch up.
It's so important, because these are real illnesses. We see them clinically, we see them in the research. Mm-hmm. We need them to be diagnosable. So, right. Thank you for bringing that up. It's a really important piece. Let's talk about treatment and what we do to help our patients who have mold, mycotoxin illness, the allergies, all of it.
Sure. So with mycotoxin illness, it's going to look so different for people. And something I say when I'm teaching other practitioners is there's no dogma in medicine. There's no dogmatism in medicine. Soon as you find a strict algorithm and you can't bust through it, or you can't bend it to change, then you have to, as a practitioner, really work to apply that to the patient. It's an art form. And so, my general global approach, it's not a protocol, it's a global approach, is really just the concept of working backwards and up through the body. Most of my clients, when they come in, most of their symptoms are neurocognitive. We have a lot of neurological issues when they come in. But getting something from the brain down through the neck to the liver and then out through the stool, that's a long pathway for things. And there's lots of ways that things can kind of bogged up and gummed up around that. So when I work with people, I typically start in the gut. I work my way backwards up through the gut, supporting the gut. I work my way into the liver and do a lot of liver support. And then I work backwards and kind of up through the body, meaning, I've gone from organ system and now I'm gonna try to do more of the cellular one-on-one support and drive. And so if you open up all the dams in the river, you're going to have a more successful treatment. And that's what I was saying earlier on, like It's boring. It's not sexy by any means. It can be a slow process. And frankly, I like a non-dramatic treatment. No one wants to go into really severe different reactions. No. Like, and so I tell people I put my oven mitts on for everyone. I am very cautious. And I've worked with people who like can't drink water without developing hives. And I just assume everyone is starting from there. So, I might do a little bit less gut support work if they're already on like a low inflammatory diet and they're gluten free and they're already doing all that stuff. Biotherapeutic drainage is one of the big core components. If you're not working with any of the phospholipids, you're just like missing it, as far as I'm concerned. Phospholipids were a huge change in my treatment practice. Yeah. And then after that, after you finally got up to the brain and helping the brain with a lot of detox, something that gets left on the table at that point, that's when I work up SIRS. If I go through that process and I've detoxed you and you're feeling great, then great. Like you're welcome to go. I'm here. Come back to me if you need anything. But if they're still kind of feeling funky and a little inflamed, that's when I work up SIRS, because I found that if I do the SIRS workup early, I spend tons of money. And if I get people out of exposure, like 60 to 70% of my clients clear up if we just address the mycotoxin component. So again, that's why it's really important that I kind of group the different disease states so I can understand what's happening in the system. And then kind of if SIRS does come up and we address it, the final thing that really gets left on the table by a lot of physicians is tonifying the systems. It's great to like go through and detox and clean up inflammation and kind of get them back to a steady state. But okay, so what's happening with sleep? Okay, let's try to bring some more foods back in. Let's, balance your sex hormones just a little bit more. So I feel like that gets missed a lot. And that's something that's such a core of naturopathic practice. But you can't do that until you've like laid the foundation. You need functionality to make that stick.
Yeah, I tell my patients, we have to get rid of the offenders and treat the symptoms at the same time, because they're in a lot of pain, they're in a lot of stress in their body. So treating the symptoms, treating mast cells, treating the immune system, and detoxification before I even start to kill the infections, get them prepared to kill the infections. But then once we start to remove the triggers, the system is still often not in balance. So we can, one of the key piece of naturopathic medicine is treat the cause. And that's great. We do treat the cause. However, what's missed in this patient population is once you treat the cause, there's a lot more rebalance that needs to be done. We need to re-educate the immune system. We need to retrain the nervous system, the limbic system, the vagus nerve. There's so much retraining that has to go on. We're not just done once you remove the trigger. That's when I'll start to bring in regenerative medicine as well. It's a whole, I tell my patients that once we're finished with symptoms and removing the triggers, we're on section two, which is regenerative medicine, truly, and retraining.
And some people don't realize that could be like, if you're lucky, that's 6 months in, but typically that's like a year, year and a half too, like even longer for people. It took you a long time to get sick in most instances. It's going to take a while to recover, because you're asking an already problemed system to work and healing takes work. And if you can't even get the engine going, it's going to take that much longer.
It takes a long time for patients. 6 months, you're right, is lucky. Those are the people who are young. They come in, they're in their 20s. They haven't been sick for very long and been sick for maybe a year or two.
Right.
6 months is lucky, but usually it's a year or two, could be longer. Depending on how long the person has been sick for, how long they've been exposed for, what their genetic tendencies are, what's happened epigenetically for them. Well, there's so much to consider. So Dr. Tessé, tell us how patients can be in touch with you. Are you accepting new patients? And also tell us about the gift that you have to give to
our viewers. Yeah. So for today, for the viewers, I have put together essentially a mycotoxin cheat sheet that's going to go over some of the more common mycotoxins that you can test for, because I'm not going to include stuff you guys can't test for and find in your body. And on that, there is information about how it manifests in the body, and potentially like where it's found, what species of mold makes it. So that way you have like a really nice reference sheet. And then of course, people are always welcome to go to my website and download the Mold Prevention 101, which is kind of like a checklist for the home, essentially, to go around and understand where there can be problems and issues in the home. And so that way you get used to just doing normal inspections to keep that routine maintenance in the home. And of course, people can find me on all of the social media platforms. I'm on all of them. And then I also do in-person medical care, but I also do educational wellness consults for people who have a local provider who is overseeing them and taking care of them. Then I also do one-on-one kind of educational training with physicians too, who are kind of looking for maybe a little bit of support, handholding, or looking to dive in a little bit deeper. And then of course, I would be remiss to not mention ICI, where practitioners can go to learn more about these topics. But then even general members, like we invite the public, you can guys even join as a supporting member to express your appreciation and gratitude for ICI. So I think that's how people can get a hold of me.
Great. Well, thank you, Dr. Tessé. It was such a pleasure to interview you, and I look forward to more work with you.
Oh, thank you so much for today, this opportunity. Thank you for your service in doing this. Obviously, this is a really wonderful thing that you guys are doing for people. I just wish everyone good luck on finding your path, or helping a friend and family member find their path back to health through all of this. Thank you.
Thank you.